Hello and welcome to our weekly podcast of Who's Here in the Hamptons. I'm Dan Rettiner, your host, broadcasting from my home in the Hamptons, where I have lived for over 55 years. I've written a dozen books about this glorious place, and I've seen it grow through the years from small tourist towns, quaint fishing villages, and a summer playground for high society, to what it is today, a world-class resort for celebrities, artists, musicians, authors, and billionaires. In my podcast, I will bring you interviews with not only these people, but also prominent local people who have helped shape the Hamptons. Welcome to Dan's Talks. My guest today is Susan Lacy, the film producer of 25 years working, producing American Masters interviews for PBS, and most recently, producer of a film about Billy Joel, entitled Billy Joel and So It Goes, which you can watch now on HBO. And it premiered this year's Tribeca Film Festival in New York City. So I'd like to ask you about that, and then we'll talk more about it, about how you came to do it. I was amazed watching it myself about how in the world did you find all this film? But we'll get to that. And it must have been working. It's just an amazing thing. I would recommend anyone stay up two nights in a row to watch this. Billy, as you know, is a local guy, and he's had an amazing life. And get the idea you wanted to do this project?
I was the producer and the director of the film, which matters because there are several producers on it that actually didn't have very much to do with making the film. So I was the director, and I had a co-director, a young woman I've been working with for a long, long, long time, and it was her first directing gig. I actually came to this, I was asked to do this by Tom Hanks's company, Playtone, Tom Hanks and Gary Getzman. I had earlier, many years earlier, spoken with Billy's management about doing something, but they weren't ready yet for it. And so that kind of didn't go anywhere. And then I had a call from Sony. Was I interested in making a film about Billy Joel? And I said, well, I've been talked to the management before. Are you guys in sync? And that didn't go anywhere. And then I get a call from Tom Hanks's company saying, we've been approached about co-producing a film on Billy Joel, but we only will do it if you direct it. So 5 years after I first started this conversation, it came back to me. So that's how it came around. And I was not you mentioned I created a series called American Masters, which went on the air in 1986. I ran it for 30 some years before I was essentially poached by HBO 12 years ago to come and just make films there. Which I'm very happy I did because they are wonderful to work with. They appreciate artistry. They give you the time and the space you need to make these kind of films. And I don't have to raise all the money, which I had to do at PBS. So it's been a wonderful, wonderful move since I left there. But I'm obviously made a lot of films about artists. And I started the series in order to create a library of American cultural history. And I didn't start directing films for a long time, but I started directing them about 10 years in. And those films that I directed brought me to the attention of a number of people, including HBO. But music is my great love. My parents were both musicians. My mother was a concert pianist, like Billy's father was a classical pianist, not a concert pianist. My mom was. And I made films about Leonard Bernstein and Paul Simon and, Lena Horne, David Geffen, who's not really a musician, but a musical figure important in the music business. So, but I didn't know that much about Billy. And so it was a real journey of discovery for me, finding out about this extraordinary musician that I really think most people had no clue that he was something beyond the hits. Something beyond Uptown Girl and We Didn't Start the Fire, that there is a deeply intellectual, thoughtful, well, incredibly well-read, complicated, as you can possibly be, figure behind these songs. And so I tried to bring my discovery of all these things about him His incredible musical knowledge, his virtuosity, his deep roots with classical music, his family history, which was basically a kind of unknown story about the Holocaust impact on his life, the abandonment of his father. I mean, all of these things were, I tried to bring that into this film and make a kind of layered portrait of him.
Did it take you from start to finish to do this project?
Well, it was about a little over about 3.5 years I started earlier than I was ready to start, because he was going to come back and do a first concert after the pandemic that he hadn't been performing. Obviously, nobody was doing anything. And he was coming back to do a concert at Fenway after the pandemic, the first time. And the band hadn't been together for over a year. And they were going to rehearse for getting ready for this Fenway concert in Boston. And I thought, oh, that'd be really interesting to shoot, because I want to see the interaction with the band. And he's getting together with the band after he hasn't been together for a year. And so we went to this place in Pennsylvania, which is an extraordinary place called in Lititz, Pennsylvania, which is the middle of Amish country. And there's this huge facility there where rock bands go to prepare for their tours, Broadway shows go to build their sets. And it was this enormous place with Amish wagons going by in the middle of nowhere. And it was really fun. So I got to meet the band early on and see how Billy interacted with them. And that footage is at the beginning of the film. But I wasn't really ready to start yet, because I hadn't read every single thing about him. I prepare very, I go to great lengths to prepare for my interviews. And so I hadn't read everything yet. I hadn't seen everything yet. And by the way, I still haven't seen all of the thousands of hours of footage that we uncovered. The editors do that. And then they come to us and they say, these are the, you know, you can't look at every piece of concert footage. I mean, you never, ever finish making a film. But they would bring the highlights. And I had a great, great group of people. You know, our associate producers, Sony was really helpful. A guy named John Jackson, is at Sony. Enormous amounts of stuff were uncovered in the archive there that they didn't even know they had. I don't know if you remember the early Billy is a young man alone playing Piano Man.
Yes.
That was filmed on the day that he signed with Columbia Records, and it had never been seen before. We found it in the Sony archives, and that was a really big discovery. But it's a huge job finding all this material. And we look under every rock and have a great team of people helping us with that. So I don't do all of it. I'm not in the library pulling the stuff out of the archive myself. But then the editors go through it all and bring me and my co-director the highlights, which is still hundreds of hours of stuff. And that I do look at. And then I do a lot of interviews. I did 10 interviews with Billy. I started with neutral territory. I started with classical music because I know a lot about it. I know that's his great love. Beethoven is his hero. And I knew we really had a great interview talking about classical music and composition and harmony and inner voicing and how he took that and used it in his compositions and with lots of examples of it. It was a wonderful interview. And then I did an interview with him about his family history, which he didn't even know until he was in his 20s, that his father abandoned the family when he was about 7, and he didn't hear anything from his father. He didn't know if he was dead or alive. And he happened to be on tour in Europe, and he asked Columbia Records. He said, I know my dad's in Europe someplace. I don't know if he's dead or alive. Could you try to find him for me? And they did. And he found him in Vienna. And he found out he had a half-brother who was about 5 at the time. And that's how Billy began to learn about the Holocaust background of his family. He came from one of the richest families in Germany. And they got out by the skin of their teeth, his grandparents and his father. And his father, they eventually got here. His father and my father came to America the same year from Germany. So that was another bond that we had. My father's Jewish, escaped in time, and they both became American soldiers and went back to Germany as American soldiers. So that was another bond that we had in common. So I started with those things in our first two interviews, and I think it became comfortable with me and realized that this wasn't going to be your typical drive-by Wikipedia version of a documentary, which many people still make. That it was going to be a deep dive. And he came on board with that, and we did another 8 interviews, and I think he opened up. So I think when Billy realized that, because I think, I don't know that he understood, I think he was, honestly, I think his management talked him into doing this. He said, it's time to do this. You're turning 75. The residency isn't going to last forever. It's time for your story to be told. And so he kind of, I think, in a way, almost came reluctantly to this. But I actually feel pretty good to say that after these first couple of interviews, when he saw that this was a serious enterprise, and that we were really interested, my co-director and I really wanted to understand who he was. We really wanted to understand what inspired his music. We wanted to really explore process and craft and get underneath the surface of this person who'd been in the public eye for 50 years, and people think they knew, but didn't. And he went along with it, and he came to the table and participated in these next 8 interviews. And I think he went pretty deep with them. As I've started to say, I have this concept that everybody has 10 layers. And if in these kinds of films, you can get through 7 of them, done a good job. But I think there's always a few layers that you can't get through.
Well, you follow him through all his intimate moments and with family and friends, and his actually brilliant ability to make music in ways that just have been around forever and continue to be so accepted by everyone.
You know, Billy's music is, his songs, as he about 30 years ago, he stopped writing songs. But up till then, the songs are a roadmap of his life. I mean, he's completely autobiographical. That actually really surprised me. And I made his lyrics part of the narrative of this film, because he charts his life. It's almost as if he ripped a page from a diary, you know, each time he wrote a song, you know, so you know everything, you know, about his heartaches, you know, about his trepidations about going to California, his guilt about stealing his best friend's wife, you know, his longing, his heartache that he had when his first love left him and he had to woo her back. It's, you know, his pissed offness with the music business. It's all there in his songs and his lyrics. And that was really fun to work with both, you know, the upside and the downside. I mean, Billy's had a lot of downsides in his life too. And that's also in his lyrics, and he charts it all.
Well, how's the reception for this thing? And I can't imagine this is like over the moon.
It's unbelievable. I mean, I've made a lot of films. I made films about Leonard Bernstein and Joni Mitchell and Paul Simon and Leonard Bernstein. I said that Steven Spielberg, Jane Fonda. You know, I've never seen a response to a documentary like this one. And we're all a little overwhelmed by it, frankly. Billy says he said, I'm more used to the slings and arrows. So he doesn't quite trust all this, you know, all this overwhelmingly positive response. I think he keeps waiting for it to go away. But this film is somehow in the zeitgeist. And the reason I talked about the autobiographical nature of it is he is telling stories. And he is telling the stories of his life, which many people have experienced the same things. So people listen to his music and they feel like they're talking about themselves. And I think that is the reason he has sustained for so long and finds new generations of audiences constantly. I mean, you think about a guy who was able to sell out Madison Square Garden once a month for 10 years, which is a phenomenon. Nobody's ever done that before. Nobody's ever done that before. And it's all on the basis of a catalog, because he hadn't written a new song in 30 years. That's amazing. I can't think of very many artists who could do that. And I think it's because he's speaking to people. He's telling their stories too.
Who else have you done that stands out in your mind that you'd like to talk about?
Well, Steven Spielberg, I love making that film. I mean, it was, I actually tried not to think about the fact that I was making a film about the most famous filmmaker in the world, because I would have actually not been able to do it. I would have been stymied and frozen and scared. I just said, I'm going to just get behind this guy and I'm going to find him in his movies. So I focused on him as a director, not as a producer, not as a business guy and all that, just finding Steven in his movies. Because again, they are not entirely, but very much drawn from his own stories, too, his own autobiography. And he ended up making a movie about that after my documentary called The Fablemans. But he's a master filmmaker, and I got to know him very well too. I did 40 hours of interviews with Steven Spielberg. I don't think anybody's ever done that before, and nobody will ever do it again, I don't think. And he was also very giving, and I want to stress something because it's really important to me and my team that people know that the subjects don't have any control over these films. They sign something saying they have no control over these films. And the only thing that they have control over is their own interview. So we show them the film right before we're locking picture, literally like days before. And if there's something in there that they said that they wish they hadn't said or just don't want it in there, they have a right to take that out. And I do that because they're much more comfortable in these interviews because they know that they have an opportunity to look at it and see whether they want it in the film or not. And I've never had one single time that anybody said they wanted something taken out. But they don't see these films till they're practically really done. And that's important to us because, and Billy, at the very beginning, I asked him if there were any sensitive areas. And I said, not that I'll necessarily stay away from them, Billy, but I kind of want to know what they are. And he said, Susan, tell the truth. It's your film, not mine. Just tell the truth. That's the only thing I ask. And he honored that. And we told the truth. And it's not always a happy story, but it has a happy ending.
Yes. How did you get into this? Where are you from originally? Are you a New Yorker?
I was actually born in New York after the war. My father came back after the war. He met my mother in Germany during the occupation because he was studying music and he went to concerts. And my mother came on stage because she was a concert pianist, and he brought her to New York. So we had a rough time at the beginning, but eventually we ended up in Baltimore and life got easier. But I grew up with music. I mean, every Sunday we had to learn a new piece of music before we were allowed to play. So I really, really know music, and particularly classical music, obviously. And I went to graduate school. I got a master's in American studies. I got did everything, a doctorate, except writing a dissertation. I think American Masters was my dissertation. And I got into television by just luck. I mean, everybody says, oh, what was the career path? I have never known a career path that was actually linear at all, unless you want to be a doctor or a lawyer or something. Most people, it's a little bit of luck, a little bit of serendipity. You follow your instincts, your loves, the things that interest you, and it'll land you someplace, hopefully, and landed me in television. And I thought I was going to be a scholar. So I got to television, got to Channel 13. I had been living in Rome with my first husband, who was the head of the American Academy in Rome. And then we were moving to New York, and he was becoming the president of Cooper Union. And I got a call from the president of Channel 13 saying, I hear you're moving to New York. I'd like to meet you. So, because I had written something about television and the arts, very gutsy thing that only a young woman would write who knew nothing, but I thought I could do better. So he told me to come put my money where my mouth was. And I ended up at Channel 13, and I got involved as a deputy head of arts and performance programs. And one day I said, we're doing all these full-length dramas and ballets and theater, and I'm always really interested in the people who created those things. And I had this idea to do American Masters, which was logical given my academic background. And nobody thought it was a good idea. Nobody thought it was a good idea. PBS laughed at me. And they said, nobody will watch these things. And I said, well, if you make them right and you don't do them on your parents' credit card and you put it on at 3 o'clock in the morning and you make them, because these are amazing stories. The stories of artists are incredible stories. They are full of ups and downs and battling demons and battling traditions and changing in art forms. And they're ultimately very transcendent. And this record must be made. And I set out to do it with very little support from anybody. And still on the air 40 some years later.
You did over 200 of them.
Yep. Before I left. And we were very honored. I mean, look, eventually PBS had to take it seriously because we kept winning all these awards. We actually won the Emmy for Outstanding Documentary Series, 10 years in a row, which is unheard of.
They're behind you as we speak.
Yeah, I got a whole bunch of them here. I was trying to get it in the picture, but I couldn't figure out how to do that. And, you know, I didn't make every film in American Masters. I want to be really clear about that. Of 250-some films, I directed 7. But I made them happen, and I picked the subjects, and I picked the filmmakers. And sometimes great filmmakers would come to me with an idea. And if I thought that was a good marriage, you know, I'd get behind it. So I worked with some of the best documentary filmmakers in the world. And but I got to choose the subjects. And I don't want to disparage anybody in particular at PBS, but I have to say that when I would say, this is the coming season, these are the things we're doing, I would get very little response until I would have like some popular figure, you know, some either a pop star or a rock star or a film star. And, you know, I was determined that this series was going to have integrity, called American Masters, which meant people had a significant body of work that had changed our culture in some way. So I did things like Martha Graham and Alfred Stieglitz and the group theater and, you know, things. I was in a constant battle with PBS about it. And but when we won so many awards, they finally, you know, accepted that. But when I felt very vindicated when Time magazine came out with their 100 most important Americans of the century list, and about 30% of that list were cultural figures. And I took that 30% and I showed it to PBS, and Alfred Stieglitz was on the list. I said, see, you know, there is some reasoning behind this. People who really influence our culture. And we had at that point made films about three quarters of the people on that list we had made films about. And a lot of people tease me that I started this series to make a film about Leonard Bernstein and Bob Dylan, and finally got Bob Dylan. I did not direct it. I produced it. Martin Scorsese directed it, but it was a high point. And to some degree, it spelled the how much more difficult it was to continue to do American Masters, because it was very expensive. We got a lot of money from Paramount for the DVD rights. We sold a lot of DVDs. We sold over 1 million, which was a lot 18 yeah. years ago, whenever it was. And all of a sudden, everybody else looked up and went, well, there's an audience for this. We didn't know. Up till then, American Masters was really kind of the only place where biographies of this kind, I call them film portraits, but were being made. And then all of a sudden, you know, HBO and all these people went, wait a minute, there's something here. And they had a whole lot more money. So I knew it was going to be hard to continue to do the really, really big names, because people with a lot more money had now gotten into the game. It's an interesting situation to find oneself in.
How did you work that out?
I left. I went to HBO. So I wouldn't, because I knew I couldn't continue. I would not be able to continue to bring in the kind of really big names that people that we, you know, we would lose them all to people with a lot more money. We would never be able to do a Dylan again. And it would be, and by the way, there's still a very important place for American Masters, because there are those Martha Grahams and Balanchines and group theaters and Stella Adlers and, you know, Noguchis. I mean, that they won't find a place anywhere else. You know, they won't find that place. So it's really important to keep American Masters alive. And I'm very worried about it with what's going on with the potential decrease in funding.
What after you left, what did you do before this amazing piece that you just done?
I did Steven Spielberg, called yeah. Spielberg. I did Jane Fonda in five acts. Spielberg was at the New York Film Festival. Jane Fonda premiered at Sundance. I did a film about Ralph Lauren and then Billy Joel. So it's been four films in 12 years, but we had a couple of years where we weren't doing anything because of the pandemic.
You know what's interesting listening to the list of people that you've done? Well, so many of them were EastEnders.
Yeah, that is interesting, isn't it? There's not. That doesn't mean that all the interviews were done on the East End, but well, this attracts a lot of people. You know, it's not surprising. Jane isn't here. Jane's in California.
Yeah.
But Leonard Bernstein used to have a house here.
Yes, he did. Yeah. Jane, off of James Lane.
Yeah. Did you know? Did you know him?
I did not know. I did a lot of interviews too, but not of the quality, I think, of what you've been doing. There is a bit of the Hamptons in the Billy Joel.
Sure.
You show Christie Brinkley is showing our new home here.
I had dinner with her last night and Alexa Ray. We had a wonderful time. I brought my daughter. We had a mother-daughter evening. But she was wonderful. I mean, she's wonderful in the film. Alexa Ray's wonderful in the film, but Christy also let us look at her archive, and because we couldn't have told that story without that footage that she let us have, and so we're very, very fortunate. I have a question for you because you mentioned earlier that you'd spent a lot of time with Billy. Did you learn anything new in this film that you didn't know?
Oh yes, absolutely. I did know about the accountant who I did not, turns out I didn't know that he was his ex-wife's brother.
Yeah.
But because he never told me who it was. And interestingly, my wife, when I told her that, because I was recounting some of the things that Billy and I did together, that had happened. She said, "Well, it was in the news at the time. That's who it was."
But you were too busy writing articles for Dan's paper, so.
I think yes, I thought there were some pieces missing. I thought the biggest piece. I thought that, and it was sort of an undercurrent, was what brought him out east was that he had been a very, very in love with hardworking baymen and people of that ilk where he lived. And then that whole industry was wiped out by Robert Moses when he was a child. And they built what he did. And when he talked to me about why he wanted to be living in Sag Harbor and why he went into the boat business, it was all about, and I said all about hardworking baymen out here called Bonnickers, and of course they're in great decline now as well. Also, let me think about it. I didn't know much about. There was one detail that he told me about. He bought this house on Further Lane, for him and Christie, and when we were in it, he told me he couldn't buy it directly. He had to get a friendly, high social set person who would buy it and then sell it to him for the because of the codicils in the deed, which said it couldn't be sold to entertainers, Jews. At that time, all those houses were like
that. Actually, I did not know that story. That's really interesting.
It's two out of three.
Well, did you know? Well, it doesn't matter. Yeah, so this is actually one of my favorite films that I've ever made because I usually pick my own subjects because I already know a lot about them and I know why I want to make the film. But this was different. This was a real eye-opener for me and a real journey of discovering the music of someone who I really only knew the top hits. I had no idea what a beautifully complex musician he was. And that was really fun and meaningful to me to learn that and to explore that in this film and to bring that to other people.
Do you have a next project in mind yet?
Well, I do, but I can't talk about it yet. So we'll talk about it next time. Yes, I think several things are popping or are in the ether here. But I can't talk about it yet.
Well, I want to thank you for being on the podcast and hope to see you soon.
I hope so too. Thank you so much. Sure.